even more costly and dispiriting event to host than Eurovision. Henry's claim to be next in line after Richard II was based on his being the eldest son of Edward III's fourth son. Richard was the only surviving son of Edward's eldest son, but he had no children. Then there was Edward's second son, who died in infancy. So far, so good. Henry's problem was that Edward's third son, Lionel, Duke of Clarence, who was long dead himself, had a surviving male descendant, Edmund Mortimer, 5th Earl of March. Edmund was only 7 years old and was Lionel's daughter's grandson, so descended partly via the female line. But since he was male, and Lionel was born before John of Gaunt, this little boy had a strong claim to the throne. In summary, Edmund would have inherited under common law, but Henry was the rightful heir under what's known as Salic law, the even more sexist regal inheritance system favoured on the continent. This was the law that undermined Edward III's claim to the French throne, on the principle that if, being female, you don't have the right to inherit, you can't pass on that right even to your male heir. While observing this rule in asserting his rights in England, Henry, like his predecessors and successors, conveniently forgot it when saying he was the rightful King of France. The small earl posed no immediate threat, though Henry put him and his brother into a sort of genteel imprisonment just to be on the safe side. Neither did the man he grew into, who became a loyal retainer of the next king, Henry's son Henry. But Edmund's sister Anne later married a descendant of Edward III's fifth son, the Duke of York, strengthening the monarchical hopes of that line, if not its genes. The foundations of several dynastic claims were being spread like fragments of asbestos in the lungs of the body politic. What Henry really needed, as his reign started, were some strong signs of divine favour. Everyone was worrying about what God thought about the whole deposition thing. Kings ruled by divine right. They were crowned and anointed, but also, via the line of succession, God was deemed to have selected them. God had very clearly selected Richard II. His claim to the throne was unquestionable. Was God going to be cross that he'd been overruled, or was God cross with Richard for being so shit? The nation anxiously awaited the answer. A few signs that God was okay with Henry being king would be very welcome. I knew I shouldn't have believed him. Such signs were not forthcoming. Just a few weeks after the coronation, in January 1400, a group of senior supporters of Richard tried to seize the king and his son in order to murder them and restore Richard to the throne. Known as the Epiphany Rising, because it coincided with the Feast of the Epiphany at the end of Christmas, the attempt failed. But it cast into doubt Henry's policy of comparative leniency to the Ricardian camp. Henry did a swift U-turn on this and had Richard starved to death by Valentine's Day. This rather undermined any goodwill that his former approach may have garnered. It clearly wasn't safe for Henry to tolerate a more rightful king remaining alive in the kingdom, and to make the point that this state of affairs had changed irreversibly, Henry had Richard's body displayed in St. Paul's Cathedral on the 17th of February. Despite this, rumours that Richard wasn't dead persisted throughout Henry's reign. In 1400, there was a harvest failure, and in fact there were four others in the 13.5 years of his reign. In these pious times, this was seen as a sign of divine displeasure, and it caused widespread discontent and unrest. Henry exacerbated this situation with taxation, despite having promised to run the country using his royal revenues only. This was a silly promise to make, which, if he'd had more political experience, he would have known he'd be unable to keep. It wouldn't have helped matters for him to explain that the reason for his inexperience of the heart of government compared to many of his royal predecessors was that he was a usurper rather than the previous king's son. There were lots of rebellions, most notably led by the Percy family, whose influence had been instrumental in getting Henry the throne. As a result, they expected to be the power behind it and reacted violently to Henry's unwillingness to give them everything they wanted. There was also a long-running rebellion in Wales, led by Owen Glendower, who had himself crowned Prince of Wales, the first non-Plantagenet to do so for over a century. The reign was going terribly. Henry was perhaps the first victim in English history of the now familiar phenomenon of public opinion being disappointed by a newly elected government. when a new party is swept to power on a huge wave of fragile optimism and then faces the predictable setbacks of actually having to govern rather than just talk about it, there's a peculiar bitterness to the nation's disappointment. It's peculiar because it's tied in with self-loathing. We blame ourselves for our naivety. We might have known. We should have known. We fell for it. The political nation of England, from the major magnates down to those with a small measure of local influence, had consented to Henry's usurpation. They'd been in favour. He was such a golden boy of the 1390s, and Richard was awful. Their anger and disappointment seemed to follow the inevitable sine wave of the mood swing. When things didn't pan out perfectly, when the new king made mistakes, and perhaps even more when he was unlucky, they shook their heads and muttered, "Of course." They felt stupid and guilty for dispensing with the long-held principle of sticking with the anointed king. It's a bit bleak. Henry had long, acrimonious parliaments in which he appealed for money and got slagged off. His court was dull and pious. He said he was going to go and fight in France, like everyone now thought English kings were supposed to do, and had made Edward III seem cool even in the face of millions dropping dead covered in buboes, but he never did it. He fought only at home, against other Englishmen and the Welsh. One of the few positive, non-reactive moves of his reign was an act of Parliament that ordered all heretics to be burned. It hardly elevates the mood. This was a response to the rise of the Lollard movement, which was like an early form of Protestantism. They wanted a vernacular Bible, they didn't believe in transubstantiation, and in 1395 they even nailed their beliefs to a church door, though this was in Westminster, not Wittenberg. They were often followers of John Wycliffe, an English priest and academic who had translated the Bible into English and of whom Henry's father, John of Gaunt, had been an admirer. But Gaunt was dead, and now Henry wanted all Wycliffe's other admirers to die too. Henry was sincerely pious, but drawing attention to that quality by ordering some burnings was a canny move. It kept the church on side, which was particularly important when people suspected that God might not be. Henry and Thomas Arundel, the Archbishop of Canterbury, were very close, and Arundel had supported the usurpation. In contrast, Henry's relationship with the Archbishop of York, Richard Le Scroope, culminated in the latter's execution. Scroope had taken part in the Second Percy Rising against Henry. Despite all this grimness and crisis, Henry's regime was not overthrown. It continued. He weathered every storm, suppressed every rebellion, got through every parliament. It's tempting to call him a survivor, except he didn't survive. He suffered serious and deteriorating health problems from 1405 onwards and died in 1413 at the age of 45. But he died as King of England and was more secure on his throne at his death than at any other time in his reign. His poor health was also taken as a sign of divine displeasure. In particular, a skin disease, which may have been leprosy, was linked to his having killed an archbishop. Skin problems aside, he had several acute attacks of illness, which may have been cardiovascular or even epileptic, it isn't really known. But it was clear that he wasn't going to make old bones, and paradoxically, this had a stabilising effect. There was no need to get rid of him. God was doing that anyway. And his son, Henry the Prince of Wales, Prince Hal of Shakespearean fame, was accepted as the heir and relatively untarnished by involvement in the usurpation. Things got more stable, but no less bleak. A glum court surrounding a king beset by horrible skin problems and persistent life-threatening fits or attacks, figuring they might as well let him die with his crown on. Henry's opening speech in Shakespeare's first play set during the reign encapsulates the man's tiredness and fading hope. "So shaken as we are, so wan with care, find we a time for frighted peace to pant, and breathe short-winded accents of new broils to be commenced in strands afar remote." He had promised to fight in France. He had dreamed of going back on crusade, back to Jerusalem. It never happened. In a final weak joke from God, Henry died in the Jerusalem chamber of the Abbot's house at Westminster. The new broils in strands afar remote were left to his son. Chapter 27. King Henry V. Henry V is pretty similar to Edward III. They were both sensationally militarily successful, mainly in France. They were both outwardly chivalrous, but with a thick streak of military brutality when required. They both promoted English national feeling through success in war abroad. They both encouraged use of the English language and hastened its journey to become the language of all classes. They both used their military success to dazzle the magnates and commons back home so that they caused very little trouble and provided lots of money for more fighting. And they both insisted that they were the rightful King of France. This was even cheekier of Henry than it had been of Edward because, looked at a certain way, he wasn't even the rightful King of England. The key difference between them is that Henry achieved a fair bit more in the French War than Edward did, and he achieved it in under 10 years, while Edward took over 50. Henry probably needed it more. He has presented himself to posterity as a glorious leader, brave, pious, honest and successful, a uniter of the nation and a provoker of intense loyalty in his followers. And these things are pretty much true about him. But his energetic projection of those qualities was also a diversionary tactic. He was distracting everyone from the weakness of his dynastic claim. His father had usurped the throne. The Plantagenet line, stretching back to Henry II, had been broken. Henry IV and Henry V are considered to be from the House of Lancaster, which is merely a cadet branch of the House of Plantagenet. This was a much weaker dynastic position than that of any English king since Stephen, and a very similar one to the kings of France who, since Charles IV died in 1328, had all been from the House of Valois, a cadet branch of the ancient House of Capet. The weakness of that Valois claim was the basis of Edward III's assertion that he was the rightful King of France, rather than any of the various men who were actually King of France. Henry had been heavily involved in government in the second half of his father's reign because of Henry IV's recurrent bouts of illness. He remembered the rebellions well, and as a teenager had been wounded at the Battle of Shrewsbury when an arrow hit him in the face. This is said to be why the famous portrait of him is in profile, though it offers no explanation of his horrible choice of hairdo. All in all, he was well aware of how fragile his family's grip on the throne had been. Turning the regime outwards, taking the fight to France, was his technique for making everyone forget about all that grubbiness with Richard II starving to death and the recurrent rows in Parliament and fights with the Percys. First, he sought to diffuse as many festering resentments about the Lancastrian usurpation as possible. He started the reign pardoning a load of enemies of his father, returning titles that had been stripped from families in the wake of various rebellions, and having Richard II's remains taken from King's Langley, where Henry IV had stuck them, ignominiously near those of the reviled Piers Gaveston, and reinterring them in the tomb Richard had designed for himself at Westminster, where his beloved first wife was already buried. This last move provided another opportunity to proclaim, "Look, Richard really is dead," to the hardcore of conspiracy theorists still eager to follow any old tramp in a gold hat willing to proclaim himself to be the former king. As in corporate manslaughter. Henry V's most famous triumph was his victory at the Battle of Agincourt on the 25th of October 1415. This is the last of the big three battles of the Hundred Years' War. Crecy and Poitiers are the other two, in which vastly outnumbered English armies thrash the French, and the most famous thanks to Shakespeare's play Henry V, of which it forms the climax. I used to find these victories very enjoyable, and now I don't so much. Does that make me a better person, or just a curmudgeon? I'm not sure the fact that I can no longer summon any jingoistic glee from a medieval battle is much help to the thousands of Frenchmen who were once slaughtered as a result of their leader's colossal strategic miscalculations. My sincere hope is that you can still get some fun out of it, and it hasn't all been spoiled by empathy and Brexit. Henry had landed in Normandy the previous August and spent weeks laying siege to the fortress of Harfleur, not to be confused with Barfleur, from which the White Ship set sail 205 years earlier. That's at the other end of Normandy. There's also an Honfleur near Harfleur, but no Bonfleur near Barfleur, so it's no use thinking there's a system. The siege involved the earliest use of cannon by an English army, which damaged the town's walls, but the weapon that clinched the encounter was surrounding the place and waiting. It surrendered on the 22nd of September. Henry garrisoned the town, noted that quite a bit of his army had died of dysentery, and wondered what to do next. It must have seemed like he'd gone to an enormous effort to little effect. He resolved to march to Calais, already an English possession, in the hope of negatively impacting the lives of a lot of ordinary French people on the way, but also of not being engaged by a much larger French army. This latter hope turned out to be futile, hence the Battle of Agincourt. The French army numbered between 15,000 and 25,000 men, mostly heavily armoured cavalry, and the English was between 6,000 and 8,000, mostly longbowmen. It had rained the night before. The ploughed land was wet and boggy and provided the perfect conditions for the French to move slowly so the English could shoot at them. It would also have been ideal for long exposure photography of the French advance, if only the technology had existed, but as discussed, we're still in an era when waiting was more deadly than guns. So the French advanced more slowly than they would have liked and were relentlessly shot at. Lots of horses were hit and started rearing and panicking and trampling. Meanwhile, other knights were trying to advance from the rear, pushing the broiling death melee towards the English archers, who were protected by stakes that had been driven into the ground and were free to keep shooting. The whole thing turned into an abattoir, albeit quite a labour-intensive and unhygienic one. Thousands of Frenchmen were killed, as against a few hundred Englishmen, and thousands more taken prisoner. Many of these were slaughtered after the battle when Henry got nervous that the French reserves might renew the fight against his still outnumbered force. This is an excellent example of Henry's selectivity when it came to being chivalrous. Perhaps the most important consequence was this. Among the dead were a lot of very important Frenchmen, and many of the bigwigs who survived were taken away and usually ransomed. Not always, though. Charles, Duke of Orléans, remained a prisoner in England for 25 years. The battle weakened France much more deeply than one lost battle would suggest. After Agincourt, Henry was in a hugely stronger geopolitical position than when his exhausted, diseased and outnumbered force had been hammering stakes into the ground in the rain on the night of the 24th of October. Burgundy and Armagnac don't mix. Even before Agincourt, France was in a terrible state. King Charles VI, who had been reigning since 1380, was severely mentally ill. He'd acceded to the throne as a child, but started to have acute episodes of mental incompetence a few years after beginning his personal rule. This prompted a struggle for power among the major players at court, which resulted in a civil war at the end of which Charles was left a pitiful and befuddled figure, cared for only by his wife and whose son had been disinherited. His grandson was Henry VI, the next King of England, and the reason I've written this potted biography of Charles is that Henry VI's life story turned out to be almost identical. That's England in the middle of the century, back to France at the start. Charles's issues were the kind that put the stigma into mental illness that nowadays everyone's trying to remove. People who are suffering with their mental health aren't running around screaming with their clothes off, shitting themselves, refusing to wash, not knowing who they are or who other people are, or thinking they're someone they're not. Well, Charles VI was. The only stereotypical symptom of insanity Charles didn't suffer from was thinking he was the King of France. On the few occasions he thought that, it meant he was having a good day. Instead, he spent long periods thinking he was made of glass and behaving with neurotic caution in case he shattered. These delusional problems for the king caused severe real ones for the large country of which he was the absolute ruler. For long periods, government had to be handled by a regency council, presided over by his wife, Queen Isabeau, but fought over by two groups of princes and aristocrats, the Burgundians, led by the Duke of Burgundy, and the Armagnacs, led initially by Louis, Duke of Orléans, until he was murdered in 1307. He was the father of Duke Charles, who was captured at Agincourt, and then by the Count of Armagnac. The murder of Duke Louis was what turned a lot of interpersonal unpleasantness into a lot of interpersonal unpleasantness involving soldiers. Civil war in France was pretty good news for the kings of England. While Henry IV just used the time for frighted peace to pant, his son saw it as the perfect context for a new broil. He invaded, and while the Armagnac faction sent an army to face him at Agincourt, the Burgundians remained neutral. That's pretty extreme, if you think about it, remaining neutral when your country's being invaded, particularly when the country is France and the invaders are English. But the hatred between the Burgundians and the Armagnacs seemed stronger than the long-running antipathy between England and France. It reminds me of the left wing of modern British politics. While in principle all the various different kinds of lefties claim that their main aim is to keep the Conservatives out of power, in practice many left-wing groupings reserve their greatest animus for each other. In fact, the hard left is inclined to dismiss the centre-left as Tories, which seems to be missing all kinds of points. First and foremost, they're not Tories. Demonstrably, it's just a point of fact. The word Tory is not open to interpretation, like some words, idiot, hero, coward, hypocrite, statesman, to give a few examples. It just means member of the Conservative Party, and none of the adherents of New Labour, so reviled by the Corbynite wing of the party, are even Tory voters, let alone members. The left often uses Tory as a term of abuse, like monster. This is forgetting that it isn't a term of abuse, but a descriptive term that many people are happy to use about themselves. If it's like monster, this is a world where monsters both exist and are often in control of the country, happily proclaiming themselves to be monsters. This is an odd context in which to label a non-monster who merely disagrees with you over various points of detail a monster. It's like Churchill calling Attlee a Nazi. I'm not, let me make clear, before any excitement or panic sets in, equating Tories with monsters or Nazis. I'm not a Tory myself, but the Conservative Party is a coherent political movement with many decent and sincere adherents. I don't support it, but I don't consider it to be so abominable that its nomenclature should be used as direct synonyms for evil. That's what the hard left does. But that's not the problem. The problem is that's all it does. Otherwise, it leaves the Tories alone, focusing its ire on people it calls Tories, but who are in fact fellow Labour supporters, just ones who are a bit more centrist, a bit more capitalistic, frankly, a bit more realistic. The irony is not lost on me, as a left-leaning centrist, that in this little section I too am reserving my criticism for other people on the left rather than Tories. I've been polite about the Tories, but I'm censuring other left-wingers for dividing the left, which is in turn divisive of me. All this lefty mudslinging is a huge help to the right. In the same way, the English were hugely helped by the conflict between the Burgundians and the Armagnacs. At the start of the Civil War, both groups would have said they were pro-French, which meant pro-poor adult Charles VI. By 1418, John the Fearless, if you say so, Duke of Burgundy and leader of the Burgundian faction, was flirting with acknowledging Henry V's claim to the French throne. It got worse. In 1419, an attempt at rapprochement with the Armagnacs was brokered, at which John was assassinated. This was understandable, as Duke John had ordered the murder of Duke Louis 12 years earlier. Sadly, this reciprocity didn't lead to the two groups calling it quits. The new Duke of Burgundy, Philip the Good, matter of opinion, signed an all-out alliance with Henry V. The Burgundians were now officially pro-English. By this stage, the leading Armagnac was the Dauphin, that is, the heir to the French throne. He was called Charles and was the fifth Dauphin of his father's reign. Charles VI's sons seemed to have a lot of trouble staying alive. So in 1419, the situation for the French royal family was grave. The king was mad, and there was a civil war going on in which only one of the two factions acknowledged the king's son as the rightful heir. The other faction wanted the King of England to inherit. On top of this, the King of England had invaded and was assiduously occupying Normandy. England takes over France forever. That's what Henry had been doing since Agincourt. He went back to England for a bit to soak up the plaudits and sign a treaty with Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund, no less, in which the empire recognised his claim to the French throne. This must have been exciting. The crazy Plantagenet claim to the French throne, Edward III's chancy punt, was getting endorsed by Europe's biggest Whig. The daft notion that the King of England was also the rightful King of France was becoming mainstream. Think on that when you next assume that all internet conspiracy theories are doomed to be blasted away by the leaf blower of reason. In the same month as the treaty, August 1416, Henry's younger brother John, Duke of Bedford, defeated a Franco-Genoese naval force at the Battle of the Seine. This relieved a siege on Harfleur and gave the English dominance in the Channel. The following year, Henry landed in Normandy and started taking it over bit by bit. This was quite different from Edward III's and the Black Prince's technique of chevauché and showy battles. This was about sieges and occupation. Henry meant to take Normandy and keep it. Paralysed by division, the French government did basically nothing, so that by August 1419, Henry's army was at the gates of Paris. This was the point at which John the Fearless took an Armagnac axe in the face at an emergency summit, and the Burgundians signed an alliance with Henry. John's skull was kept by some monks in Dijon, for reasons vaguely connected to Catholics being weird, and when, 102 years later, Francis I, the then King of France, who was not, spoiler alert, also the King of England, came to visit, they showed it to him. Whichever monk was doing the tour pointed out the axe hole, saying, "Sire, this is the hole through which the English entered France." He was right. Henry's conquering continued apace, and in 1320 the Treaty of Troyes was signed. This was as close to the absolute jackpot for Henry as could realistically be imagined. He wasn't made King of France, but he was made regent and heir to the throne. All he had to do was wait for Mad King Charles to finally shatter, or die of eating his own shit, or try to fly from the top of Notre Dame, or something else that reinforces unhelpful stereotypes about mental illness, and he would be King of France as well as England. Also in the terms of the treaty, it was arranged for him to marry Charles's youngest daughter, Catherine de Valois, for a nice merging of royal bloods. Though the basis for Henry's whole claim to the French throne was that they were already massively merged. So a nice re-merging, a non-refreshing of the genetic pot, tainted as it already was by mental illness and a propensity to premature death. I mean, Jesus, wait till they have a child. The fact that he turned out to be a complete waste of space is not exactly a bolt from the blue. That's coming up. For now, this is the happy ending of the Hundred Years' War in which England wins, and if that's how you want to remember that war and the whole England versus France aspect of medieval history, and why wouldn't you, I'd skip on from here to Edward IV and try not to think about why his other kingdom of France isn't getting much of a mention. History is relentless, like football. I find watching football boring, but I'm not immune to the appeal of institutional triumph. When Liverpool or Manchester United, it usually seems to be one of those two, wins some title, has a great season, breaks some record, I'm drawn to that happy ending. It's joyous and climactic. It often comes with a match referred to as a final. But it isn't final. They have their triumph, but then, next season, they start again, and probably do a bit worse. For me, that spoils the narrative. I've often thought that when a great club wins everything, it should be closed down. Its players and resources could split among other teams. Having achieved its destiny, its greatest triumph, it should be allowed to ascend to sporting heaven, rather than continue to scratch around on earth in the hope, at best, of repeating its triumph, but never of bettering it. I accept that this proposal would face opposition from club owners and fans, but had it always been the system, I think it would be great. In narrative terms, it was a good move of Henry V to die 2 years after his greatest triumph. He never had to deal with the fallout, the challenges of maintaining and consolidating his position. France wasn't really his. The Armagnacs, led by a dauphin determined to be King of France himself, were still in possession of most of the country, and they weren't going anywhere. After his marriage to Catherine in June 1420, Henry returned triumphantly to England where, in early 1421, Catherine was crowned and impregnated, quickly ticking off quite a lot of a Queen Consort's to-do list. In June of that year, Henry returned to France to relieve a situation caused by the defeat and death of his brother, the Duke of Clarence, in a battle against an Armagnac army. Henry spent the next year campaigning, chipping away at the Dauphin's possessions, before catching dysentery and dying in August 1422. Unlike Edward III, he never had to see himself fail. Would he have failed? Could he have succeeded in building a long-term cross-channel Charlemagne-style superstate? Probably not. Edward III couldn't, and he was a top-class king. Then again, Henry's approach was different. He was conquering northern France, not just laying waste to it. He had made alliances within the French political milieu. He would probably have failed to reign as effective king of France and England, but it's far from definite. It wouldn't necessarily have been good news for England if he'd succeeded, though. France was a far bigger, far richer, far more central state than England. It was cool and fashionable. The popes lived there for a while, which was pretty hip at the time. King of France was a promotion from King of England, so France was likely to be any joint king's priority. When the Stuart kings of Scotland inherited the English throne in 1603, they moved straight to the capital of the richer and more central of their two kingdoms. Stuart rule of England did not turn out in any meaningful sense to be Scottish rule. A long-term Lancastrian regime based in Paris would have been unlikely to remain Anglo-centric for long. Chapter 28. King Henry VI. Henry VI never met his father, but he wouldn't have remembered if he had. That's not because he was useless, though he was useless, but because he was only 8 months old when his father died. This wasn't an ideal situation. The King of England was a baby, and the King of France was mentally ill and likely to die quite soon, at which point the baby would take over as King of France as well. Who came up with this system? Henry V had come up with it, and fortunately had enough time while he knew he was dying to make some arrangements, and enough energy. I'm not sure if I were dying of dysentery, I'd be able to summon up the vigour to give a shit about, well, anything other than my next agonising shit. But then I'm fairly agnostic rather than extremely Catholic, so not quite as convinced as Henry was that I'd otherwise turn up in the afterlife and get an immediate rap on the knuckles from St. Peter for neglecting my geopolitical admin. Henry put his eldest surviving brother, John, Duke of Bedford, who was a sensible and capable chap, in sole charge of both France and the ongoing war against the Armagnacs. He left his flakier brother, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, in more equivocal charge of both England and his infant son. So there was a plan. But the situation, like any royal minority, was delicate. And this minority was going to be long, since the king had exceeded at the tender age of naught. The odd thing about Henry VI's minority, though, was that it was by far the most successful part of his reign. Overall, it didn't go amazingly well, but neither was it an unmitigated disaster. The rest of his reign was an unmitigated disaster. At the start, a regency council was appointed to run England, and while there was a certain amount of bickering between Gloucester and the king's great-uncle, Cardinal Beaufort, competent government was for the most part maintained. What's strange is that no one took the opportunity to call into question the infant king's right to rule. Henry V's charisma seems to have blasted away any question of the Lancastrian dynasty's legitimacy. Henry VI was, in England at least, the unquestioned rightful king. This wasn't due to any strengths on the child's part. It was because there was a lot of loyalty to Henry V and a strong sense that his stellar reign, and therefore his whole dynasty, had been favoured by God. Later in Henry VI's reign, questions over his legitimacy re-emerged with disastrous consequences, but his remarkably stable minority shows that this wasn't inevitable. Henry IV's usurpation had weakened the monarchy, but Henry V's successes had repaired a lot of that damage. It took rank incompetence from Henry VI to reopen all those cracks. If he'd been a half-decent ruler, the new Lancastrian succession might never have been questioned again. Obviously, England can't be in charge of France. The country of which Henry was not the unquestioned king was France. Charles VI died in October 1422, and Henry was supposedly king of it from then on, though Charles's son Charles, who was previously calling himself the Dauphin, now reckoned he was King Charles VII. Events proved him right. Not immediately, though. The Duke of Bedford was doing a bloody good job of continuing his brother's work, winning a stunning victory in 1424 at the Battle of Verneuil, where he defeated a much larger army of French and Scots, who have become almost inseparable from the French by this point. Nice work, Edward I, by sheer force of killing them one by one. Events continued to favour the English until early 1429, when Joan of Arc turned up. It seems to me that Joan of Arc was the quirky personification of an inevitable historical process. It's almost as if God or fate or chance, history's great showrunner in the sky, felt the need to jazz up an otherwise predictable narrative. England had neither the united leadership, nor the wealth, nor the international clout to take over and hold on to France. It would have been not merely like a snake swallowing a basketball, but like a fox trying to kill a hippopotamus. The English situation was bound to deteriorate, but a young French peasant woman, wearing armour and having holy visions, leading a French army while the Dauphin looked on with scepticism, turning to amazement, is a much more interesting way for that to happen. If your awareness of history comes from a primarily English or British perspective, Joan of Arc is an awkward prospect. Her role in the story makes France right and England wrong. She is a rebuke to unworthy and unrealistic ambitions and only really enjoyable from a French perspective. This is their bit, you have to say, and let the French have fun. That wasn't the view of the English at the time. The trouble with personifications of inevitable historical processes is that, unlike the processes themselves, they can be killed. So that's what the English did to her after their Burgundian allies had captured her and handed her over in exchange for 10,000 livres tournois, which is roughly equivalent in today's money to a lot. The English didn't reckon she was a personification of an inevitable historical process at all. They thought she was an annoying piece of shit, otherwise known as a heretic. It was heresy that she was convicted of in a very dodgy trial in front of a lot of pro-English priests, and then she was burned at the stake in 1431. 25 years later, the verdict was overturned, and in 1920 she was made a saint. As a trajectory of posthumous Roman Catholic respectability, this is known as a reverse Savile. The reawakening of French national morale and military success was unaffected by Joan's judicial murder. She had already seen the former Dauphin crowned King Charles VII at Reims Cathedral in 1429. This had precipitated the crowning of Henry VI as King of England at Westminster later the same year, and then, slightly desperately, of France in Paris in December 1431. French kings aren't usually crowned in Paris. Reims is the place, so it didn't feel proper, and it wasn't. The 10-year-old Henry returned to England soon afterwards and never set foot in France again. English setbacks continued apace. In 1435, the Burgundians swapped sides and the Duke of Bedford died. In 1436, the French reconquered Paris. By 1449, Rouen and most of Normandy were back in French hands, and then, in 1453, at the Battle of Castillon, Gascony fell to them. This territory had been in the hands of the kings of England for 299 years. But it was all over. Only Calais remained. England needs a grown-up. This disaster was Henry VI's cue to lose it. As I've said, the course of his life is eerily similar to that of his maternal grandfather and predecessor as incapable King of France, Charles VI. But Henry's mental health breakdown was considerably lower energy than his granddad's various collapses, yet somehow weirder. Henry went totally inert. He just froze, stopped, ceased to interact with other humans. He slumped into a catatonic state brought on by the shock of his final defeat in France. He had to be fed, washed, moved from room to room. He breathed unaided, but that was about it. It was quite an extreme reaction, but on the plus side, it showed that he got it. Something had gone badly wrong with his reign, and his total collapse was at least an acknowledgement of the seriousness of that. It was a catastrophic failure in his kingship, but ironically, his lapse into a state where he didn't seem to know what was going on was one of the few signs he'd ever betrayed of understanding what was going on. Up to that point, he'd proved to be a terrible king. Ever since the Duke of Bedford died, there'd been a power vacuum. Bedford had been really good. He'd behaved like a king. By which I don't mean that he got above himself, but that he'd balanced competing interests, fought bravely, and administered with competence. People trusted him, and without him, nobody quite knew what to do. There was no grown-up. So they looked to the king, who, in 1435, was only 13, so not a grown-up either. But he was crowned and anointed and so maybe benefited from a bit of magical God-given authority and competence. That was the hope, and indeed the premise of the whole governmental system. When can we start pretending little Henry's up to the job? The magnates wondered. The answer was 1437. Henry was 15. It's a bit young, really, but to be honest, that wasn't the main problem. His father had been a capable warrior who had led men at the Battle of Shrewsbury when not much older. Edward III had been a conscious and capable political actor when in his teens. It's possible that, had Henry VI possessed any regal gifts, he might have been able to cope with some aspects of the job at 15. But he didn't, so he couldn't. The day when he could never dawned. Where was this elusive grown-up? Henry, as is typical of weak kings, put all his faith in a favourite, in this case William de la Pole, Earl of Suffolk. This made other major magnates, such as the Duke of Gloucester and Richard, Duke of York, resentful and suspicious of him, which in turn made de la Pole ever more aware of his dependence on the king's favour. This defensiveness made him spiteful, and in 1447 he moved against Gloucester, the next in line to the throne, but someone who had largely retired from public life by that point. De la Pole had him brought before Parliament and arrested for treason. Gloucester died of a stroke before he could be tried. De la Pole eventually fell from grace in 1450 when it emerged that, as part of the deal for the king's marriage to Margaret of Anjou, which had happened in 1445, he had agreed that England would cede the county of Maine to Charles VII. This was disastrous news at a time when England was already hemorrhaging continental territory and led to his condemnation by Parliament. He was sentenced to execution, which, at the order of the king, was commuted to banishment. But then the ship taking him into exile was intercepted by a bunch of lads who executed him anyway. So Henry had never been much of a king, but his bizarre and rubbery slump of 1453 still presented a problem. The regimes of which he'd been the ponderous and timid centre, de la Pole's and then that of Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, had relied on the king's conscious assent, if nothing else. Kings were a big deal, and without going, "So we'll do this, Your Majesty, shall we?" and being able to elicit at least a tremulous "yep," these ministers' authority lacked legitimacy. They spent ages hoping he'd get better, trying to get some signs of life out of him, to elicit a few decisions on issues like who should be the next Archbishop of Canterbury by getting him to wiggle a toe or burp, but to no avail. It was a bit like when they got that octopus to predict results in the Football World Cup, except the octopus was considerably more dynamic. Something had to be done. The king was childless, though the queen was at this point pregnant, and the next in line to the throne was Richard, Duke of York. Was he the grown-up? He was 41. He'd commanded the English position in France after Bedford's death. Maybe he was. That was the hope, anyway. After some umming and aahing, after the queen had given birth to a healthy baby boy whom the king, in his weird trance, could not be prevailed upon even to acknowledge, the Duke of York was appointed Protector of the Realm. A war by any other name. York. Ring any bells? I don't mean Prince Andrew. This is differently grim. This Duke of York is the one I mentioned earlier as having re-coined the name Plantagenet to emphasise his royal lineage. He was very royal, directly descended both from the previous Duke of York, a son of Edward III and younger brother of John of Gaunt, and from the Duke of Clarence, another son of Edward III and elder brother of John of Gaunt. This complicated, boring and important fact gets a fair few people killed over the next few decades. The specific thing that will kill them is called the Wars of the Roses, and it was between the White Rose, representing York, and the Red Rose, representing Lancaster. If you don't want to know who eventually wins, avoid looking at an England rugby shirt for the next few minutes. The Roses couldn't do any of the fighting themselves. They're as inert as floppy King Henry. Still, pricks can draw blood, and the aristocracy was full of them. Historians will tell you that it isn't really called the Wars of the Roses, which is ridiculous because it obviously is. What they mean is that it wasn't called the Wars of the Roses at the time or for a long while afterwards, and they hugely exaggerate the extent to which this matters. It is not important to refer to things in contemporaneous language. The ancient Egyptians didn't call the pyramids pyramids, but that doesn't mean that they're not really pyramids. So this war, or wars, it gets pluralised because it happened in fits and starts, was between two royal factions, one led by the Duke of York and the other, well, nominally led by King Henry, who was from the House of Lancaster, but also by Queen Margaret, plus a whole clutch of vaguely royal people who wanted to seem more royal than they were are on that side. All sorts of descendants of varying levels of legitimacy of John of Gaunt, who was Duke of Lancaster, remember, most of whose surnames are Beaufort or Tudor. I bet that last word rang a bell, even if York didn't. Yes, the Tudors are shuffling about by this point, waiting for their entrance, which is coming up shortly and will allow me to end this book with their heavily televised section of the past. That should be fun, and will give you a chance to join in with the bits you know. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, to see you nice. But we've got to get the Wars of the Roses out of the way first. They're less heavily televised, possibly because they're so complicated and lack a coherent narrative arc. Shakespeare plundered them heavily for material and made it work, but he was famously very good at writing. Plus, he couldn't really do the Tudors because for the first half of his career they were in charge and very sensitive, unless described in a manner so ludicrously adulatory as to be unwatchable by anyone whose surname wasn't Tudor. At the end of his life, he collaborated on a play about Henry VIII. The Stuarts were reigning by then, so he could get away with it, but it's not what you'd call a corker. I suppose it must have been tricky for the creator of Falstaff to write about a time when the shouty, boozy Fatso was actually king. It unbalances things, like when Del Boy became a millionaire. The Wars of the Roses as quickly as possible. OK, here we go. Back to 1454, when Richard, Duke of York, had just been made protector of the realm. At this point, he showed no signs of trying to become king himself, despite having just been queue-jumped in the line of succession by the new royal baby, whom the great big royal baby, Henry, was still too bonkers to notice. York did a relatively sensible job of running the country, though he couldn't resist putting Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, in the Tower of London. Somerset had been running the government ever since de la Pole was shortened at sea, and York thought he was a traitorous dick, letting the king and the kingdom down. The terms of the conflict were still like in the good old days before Henry IV's usurpation, all about the king being badly advised or deceived or betrayed. The notion of just getting rid of him and having a different king had not yet crept back onto the agenda. Next event, Henry gets better. Hooray? No, he did less harm while he lacked motor function. But from Christmas 1454 onwards, he was up and about again, getting everything wrong. From this point on, though, he was increasingly managed slash dominated slash looked after by the Queen, who appears to have been genuinely fond of him, but who was also anxious for their son to A, inherit the throne, and B, not get killed. She was skillful and determined in this aim, but nevertheless failed on both counts. As soon as the king was well enough to once again feed himself and obsess over his plans for Eton College, which, let me tell you in case you're looking for another reason to dislike him, he founded, Queen Margaret sacked York and let Somerset out of prison to run things again. Henry's pre-collapse regime was back in business, and York stomped off to the north to start plotting with his allies, the Nevilles. The Nevilles were a lovely couple, both called Richard Neville, one father of the other. The father was the Earl of Salisbury, and the son was the Earl of Warwick, which was nice for them. Despite the locations of their earldoms, the north of England was their main power base, where they vied with the Percys to be the most important regional aristocrats. York and the Nevilles, sounds like a 1950s band, started raising an army, and the government started panicking. In May 1455, Jumpy Somerset announced a big council to be held in Leicester and summoned everyone, including York and the Nevilles, who were under strict instructions to behave themselves. But they didn't. They intercepted the king on his way there, at St Albans, where there was a fight. It was somewhere between a small battle and a massive scuffle. Somerset was killed, as was Henry Percy, 2nd Earl of Northumberland. Excuse the ordinal number, but of the 9 Percys who were Earls of Northumberland in the period covered by this book, 8 were called Henry. Number 7 was a Thomas. So York and the Nevilles were pleased, and the king was captured and taken back to London. York still said he didn't want to be king, and ceremonially handed Henry the crown. The message was, you can still be king, but please let me run things because you are a massive idiot. The person who actually started running things, though, was non-idiot but York-hater Queen Margaret, so the York faction were once again gradually sidelined and went off to plot. We've got to 1459, and a parliament was called in Coventry, without inviting Y and the N's because no one was in the mood for a disco. No, it was because the purpose of the parliament was to pass bills of attainder against them. A bill of attainder criminalises you without trial. You can bet Suella Braverman is trying to bring them back. Y and the N's fled into exile. York went to Ireland and the Nevilles went to Calais. But in the summer of 1460, the Nevilles were back with an army, defeating the king's troops at the Battle of Northampton and capturing Henry. Queen Margaret escaped. In September, York came back from Ireland, and something had changed. This is when he started calling himself Plantagenet. He arrived bearing the arms of his ancestor, the Duke of Clarence, son of Edward III. He'd had enough of trying to work round a fool of a king. At a parliament in October, he basically said, "Yes, I admit it, I want to be king, so kill me." And they did, 2 months later. He was giving battle in vain at the time, his last desperate gesture reminding millions of the colours of the rainbow. At the Battle of Wakefield on the 30th of December, a Lancastrian army led by the Duke of Somerset, son of the one who had died at St Albans, defeated a force led by York and the elder Neville. York was killed in battle, and Neville, who had escaped, was discovered later that night and beheaded. Is it over yet? No, not by any means. Richard's forthright claiming of the throne had fundamentally changed Yorkist aims. The political nation had had a good go, in the aftermath of Henry V's glories, at pretending that the office of king was somehow inviolable. Henry VI's legitimacy, the notion of his God-given right to rule, had been respected all the way through his minority and then into his feeble reign, his failures in France, the collapse of law and order, right through his year and a bit of just being a blob that ate, and then out the other side. But the Bill of Attainder against York had pushed it too far. No one had forgotten what Henry IV had done. He'd got rid of a king. Ever since 1399, it had been in the back of every magnate's mind. If the worst came to the worst, we can always do that again. For the Yorkists, this was now the plan. And they had a new candidate, Richard's son Edward, a dashing 18-year-old who was bloody good at fighting. On the 2nd of February 1461, at the Battle of Mortimer's Cross in Herefordshire, Edward's army defeated a Lancastrian force led by someone called Owen Tudor and his son Jasper Tudor, Earl of Pembroke. Who are these guys? Well, Owen was a Welsh nobleman whose claim to fame was that he had secretly married Henry VI's mother, Catherine de Valois, in 1428. They'd had some kids, Edmund, Jasper, who was at the battle, and a couple of less historically significant others. And they were all half-siblings of Henry VI, making them very different from most scions of the Welsh gentry. I imagine Owen as a bit of a charmer, a Richard Burton type. This battle was the end of his chequered career. He was captured and beheaded in Hereford, though not of the Tudors. Jasper survived. More importantly, Owen's elder son, Edmund, Earl of Richmond, had already married and impregnated Lady Margaret Beaufort, daughter and niece of various Dukes of Somerset, before dying in 1456. In 1457, she gave birth to a son called Henry, who possessed quite the jazzy cocktail of royal blood. As well as the Tudor stuff from Wales, he descended directly from the French House of Valois through his grandmother, the Dowager Queen of England, and from the English House of Plantagenet through the Beauforts, who descended from John of Gaunt. This might sound like an over-involved episode of Who Do You Think You Are, but unlike Danny Dyer's ancestry, it turned out to be important. Not yet, though. Victorious Edward now headed for London, where he joined forces with the remaining Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, who had just been beaten at the Second Battle of St Albans, losing Henry VI in the process. Henry had spent the whole battle sitting under a tree singing, and now he was back with his wife. Undaunted by this setback, on the 4th of March 1461, Edward was proclaimed king. Now there were two of them. Shit. Chapter 29. King Edward IV. There may have been a new king, but the old king was still very much around, singing and praying and kissing his wife. So the start of Edward's reign wasn't a nice, certain new beginning. just like when Henry VI was crowned in Paris after Charles VII had also been crowned at Reims, it was a political assertion, an aspiration more than a fact. Would Edward assert his rule in England more effectively than Henry had in France? Yes, he would. On the 29th of March, 1461, at Towton in Yorkshire, Edward won the largest and bloodiest battle ever fought on English soil. Henry VI and Queen Margaret were there, but managed to escape to Scotland with their young son, also called Edward, and who was, in their view, the Prince of Wales. That complication aside, it was a decisive triumph for Edward of York, which left a very large number of senior Lancastrians dead. That, you'd think, would be the end of the Wars of the Roses, but I'm sorry to say it isn't. This war is reminiscent of the process of disentangling a very long string of Christmas lights. You sort out one bit, and then there are just more twists, more tangles. Next one. Edward secretly married a woman who was his considerable social inferior. She was still pretty posh, but he was the king, and she wasn't posh enough. But she was definitely pretty enough. She was called Elizabeth Grey, née Woodville, and she was the widow of a man who had died fighting on the Lancastrian side at the Second Battle of St. Albans. So, in every way, extremely unsuitable. Edward kept the marriage secret because he knew it would go down badly with Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick. Kings weren't supposed to marry their subjects just because they fancied them, or even loved them, or at all. Royal marriage prospects were a major diplomatic resource, and Edward had squandered it out of lust. Neville had been trying to cement a treaty with Louis XI, the new King of France, by getting Edward to marry Louis's sister-in-law. When he discovered, in October 1464, that 4 months earlier the king had married a commoner, he was mightily pissed off. Edward's marriageable prospects were not the only finite resource that Elizabeth Grey monopolised. She also hugely reduced the number of titles, honours, jobs and patronage available to Warwick and his cronies because she applied so much pressure on Edward to show favour to her large and impecunious family. The initial secrecy can only have made the situation even more annoying for Warwick. This was stupid and cowardly of Edward. But he wasn't a stupid and cowardly man in general, and this counterproductive subterfuge is a reminder that he was still a kid. That was how Warwick viewed him, the young son of his longtime ally Richard of York, whom he had helped to the throne. Warwick has come to be known to posterity as the Kingmaker. He felt he'd made one king, Edward. As the 1460s wore on, it started to occur to him that he could always make another. This may have been going through Warwick's mind in 1465 as he was escorting Henry VI to the Tower of London. The silly old king had been hanging around the north of England for over a year, sofa surfing at the castles of various supporters, ever since the Lancastrian defeat at yet another battle, Hexham, the previous May. But the Lancastrian cause wasn't quite finished. Henry's queen and their son were still at large in France, currying favour with the very king with whom Neville had wanted to make a marriage alliance. Neville has lost the knack. Thanks to Neville, here comes another flurry of Wars of the Roses. He joined forces with George, Duke of Clarence, one of Edward's younger brothers, who didn't feel enough of a fuss was being made of him compared to Edward's in-laws. In 1469, Clarence married Neville's daughter Isabel, and then the two of them rebelled, defeated a royal army at the Battle of Edgecote in July, imprisoned Edward IV in Middleham Castle, and executed a brace of Woodvilles. This would have been a great moment for the Kingmaker to make another king, but he couldn't manage it. He had a go, but nothing happened. Let's hope Clarence said, "That's fine, these things happen, you're probably just tired." The vibe of the kingdom was that there were still only two possible kings, Henry VI and Edward IV. Unfortunately, they were both in prison. That situation was unsustainable, so Neville let one of them out, Edward, who then carried on ruling for a bit. As you can imagine, there was a real atmosphere. An uneasy truce continued for a while, but Warwick and Clarence weren't having a very nice time. For example, Edward replaced John Neville, Warwick's younger brother, as Earl of Northumberland with Henry Percy. Percy had previously been 4th Earl of Northumberland, but the Percys had been stripped of the title for being on the Lancastrian side. Henry Percy, the 3rd Earl, had been killed fighting for Henry VI at Towton. When the earldom went to John Neville in 1465, that was a big win for the Nevilles in the Neville-Percy struggle to be the biggest northern magnates. Equally, Edward's reinstatement of Percy in 1470 was a 15th-century way of telling Warwick to fuck off. So Warwick and Clarence rebelled again in March 1470, but it didn't work, and the two of them fled to France. There, King Louis XI of France, eager for England's paralysis by civil war to continue, introduced them to Queen Margaret of England, who was initially frosty, but then spotted an opportunity, so they all teamed up. In September, Warwick and Clarence landed in Devon, while John Neville marched down from the north. Edward IV was caught in a pincer movement and, along with his other brother, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, fled to Flanders. Warwick assumed control of England and, since he couldn't seem to make another king, used an extant one. He restored Henry VI to the throne. I know. I am so sorry. It feels like we're getting nowhere. Chapter 30. King Henry VI, the Readeption. The word set famously has more different meanings and uses than any other in the English language. It does a hell of a lot of work. The same cannot be said for the word readeption. Readeption just means restoration to the throne and is used exclusively to refer to Henry VI. No one else's restoration, and there have been a fair few over the centuries, is called a readeption. It is the special word just for the time when Henry VI started being king again for a bit, 9.5 years after he'd been deposed. For most people, this was a depressing development. The Yorkists, obviously, most of the ordinary people because they were sick of civil war, Henry VI himself because it just meant more stress. Most importantly, it's depressing for you and me, because we felt we were getting somewhere, didn't we? Henry had been a terrible king, and there'd been disastrous consequences, and pressure had built up until finally he'd been overthrown. It was dramatic and nasty, but like a violent bout of vomiting after hours and hours of feeling horrendously ill, it was for the best. Better out than in is a fair verdict on Henry VI's relationship with power. And better in than out summarises his relationship with the Tower of London, if you ask me. This may be unfair on the poor weirdo, but whenever he was wandering freely around the place, he tended, like a bewildered queen bee, to become the focus of lots of dangerous activity, a buzzing of troops and supporters spoiling for a battle against some Yorkists. This little coda to Henry VI's calamitous reign reminds me of Napoleon's Hundred Days, when, 9 months after he'd been defeated, deposed, and sent to rule the tiny island of Elba, the disgraced emperor came back to France, took over the place effortlessly, and restarted the war. A weary Europe had to get its shit together to defeat him again. It's also like when the last Chinese emperor, who'd been forced to abdicate a couple of decades earlier, was set up as leader of the Japanese puppet state of Manchuria in the 1930s. And bleakest of all, it's like the last 15 minutes of the mediocre 1994 Mel Gibson film Maverick, the several false endings of which were accompanied for me, when I watched it with friends at university, with the dawning realisation that we were all going to miss last orders at the pub. The new Warwick-led Lancastrian regime didn't last long. Henry was a more pitiful figure than ever, shambling around in dirty old clothes, barely understanding what was going on. Warwick was in charge, but most of the Lancastrians who supported the readeption hated him for orchestrating their downfall a decade earlier. The Queen and her son didn't even make it to England before the regime started collapsing, hot on the heels of Edward IV returning from Flanders with an army. He landed in March 1471, defeated and killed Warwick at the Battle of Barnet in April, and then defeated the Queen and her son, who had just arrived with another army, at the Battle of Tewkesbury in May. The Lancastrian Prince of Wales, another Edward, was killed at this battle, and Queen Margaret, broken in spirit by the death of her